In small-town Iowa, it can feel like everyone knows everyone else's business. And that's true when it comes to racism, too.
The kids come up to me and they're like, "Oh, Miss Kelly," and they hug me, and I'm like, "You just called my daughter the N-word."
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices, continues. This hour, we travel outside the state's urban areas where many Black Iowans are likely to be the first or the only. I'll talk with Kelly Gosch, who's raising her three kids in Cresco in northeastern Iowa. Chris Robinson grew up in western Iowa in the 60s and 70s, where his family was the first Black family in an all-white neighborhood. And Ty Rushing is a journalist in Sheldon, up in the northwest corner of the state. He has a whole host of firsts to his name. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices. All week long, I'm talking with Black Iowans about their lives, experiences, and ideas. Most of the people I've talked to so far this week live in Des Moines, Waterloo, Cedar Rapids, or Iowa City, and that's not a coincidence. The African-American population in our state is small, approximately 4%, and the majority of Black Iowans live in our larger cities. Today, we're heading out of the cities into small towns or rural Iowa. My first guest is Kelly Gosch. She lives in Cresco in northeastern Iowa with a population of about 3,700. According to Gosch, just 12 adults in Cresco are Black. She is the varsity cheer coach at Cresco High School, dance director of Just for Kicks Dance, and owns and operates a small business called Bathhouse Market. She is also the mother of three.
Tell me what brought you to Iowa.
Love. My husband, he grew up here, and we lived in Jacksonville, Florida. That's where we met. We've been married for 20 years now. So 6 years ago, he had just got back from Afghanistan. You know, we just needed a change of pace for all of us. So we thought that moving here where he has family, so we'd have a support system so that we could just live a little bit quieter life.
Your husband is white.
Yes, he
is. You are Black.
Yes, I am.
In moving to Iowa, what was going through your mind? I mean, you had obviously visited Iowa before. You had visited Cresco.
Yes.
You knew what you were getting into to some degree.
Yes, I knew that I would be probably the only other Black person here. Like you said, I visited. Everybody seemed nice. So, you know, I'm like, we're living in his childhood home, which is a very nice home. So I'm like, ah, this is great. It'll be good. Change of pace. Low life, small town. Yeah.
Well, and right now your husband is deployed, so you're on your own three kids right now.
I am. I am on my own with a teenager that just started driving.
Wow.
Thank God. she's been helping me. And I have a set of twins that are 11. They're in fifth grade. So, yeah, we have a very busy schedule on top of my own schedule.
I want to talk about your kids. I mean, in moving to Cresco, you have found that your kids have encountered racist slurs and all kinds of really just hurtful things ever since you've arrived, including a terrible event that happened just over the weekend. Tell me about that.
You know, being in a white population, I assume there would be some, you know, some ignorance towards me as an adult because I am Black, but my children, you know, society says if it's 1 ounce of Black, that's what you are, even though they don't look, you know, they all look different, you know. So my oldest daughter, so we moved here when she was 8 and she was in third grade. And yeah, that was her first encounter with the N-word. And I thought the school handled it appropriately other than not contacting me. when it happened, they contacted the perpetrator's parents, and he got to go home. And then I had a confused third grader coming home to me trying to explain a situation that she didn't even understand.
She had never heard that word before.
Correct. She's never heard that word before. So she didn't even understand why people were so upset. So again, the school handled it swiftly. They, you know, they separated them, called the kids' parents. I felt that they did everything that, given the information that they had, and, you know, they were appalled. So that was a tough conversation that I had with her that day. And so I tried to cram, you know, 400 years of history into a 15-minute conversation to a third grader. Mm-hmm. But she was amazing, and she's remarkable. And she looked at me after that, and she said, "So they're calling me the N-word because you're Black." And I was like, "Oh my gosh, yes, they are." I started crying, and I'm like, "Yes, I'm sorry, I'm Black." And she's like, "It's not your fault you were born Black." You know, a child's reasoning is the best. You know, they take everything at face value. So from there on, she has been called the N-word, I don't know, multiple times a year. I want to say more than 10, less than 20, which is a lot. When you think of like a 7-8 month school year. So like every other week I was at school. So, but she is way better than I am. I feel like, she actually, 'cause I've never been called that to my face. So I didn't even know what she was going through. So as a mother, you know, you hurt for your kids, but to not be able for her to go through that type of Black experience, and I had never been through it, and still have never been through it, shocked the heck out of me. But recently, so I was working a night shift, and my neighbor calls me and says, "Hey, I'm at your house. I'm going to stay here." My neighbor also happens to be Black, and he's married to a white woman. They just got married. So he's like, "I'm going to stay here until you get home," because they're scared. So she was prank called. And the caller called her.
And this
times.
Is your 11-year-old daughter.
Yes, 11-year-old daughter. So yeah, called 8 times. The N-word was used over and over again. So like when they answered the phone, it was in. And then one of those calls is the calls that scared her. They were like, "We know where you live." And so my oldest called my neighbor. So the cops ran the phone number. They figured out where the phone call came from. They went on Saturday night at 10:30, and the kid admitted it, but then said that he did it because another kid told him to do it. So they were going to follow up with an investigation on the other kid. They did, and because they both admitted it, I can press charges, which I'm going to. I just feel, you know, after 6 years of my daughter and the school not being able to do anything, which baffles me, that if they admit it outside of school, I can press charges. But when they do it in school, I can't.
We're going through so much right now. I mean, you've been experiencing this with your kids mm-hmm. for yeah. 6 years.
Yeah.
But of course, after George Floyd was killed and we saw that igniting a national and really worldwide conversation about systemic racism.
Yeah.
You also have been having those conversations in Cresco. What's
yes.
been going on?
So there is a wonderful, wonderful advocate here. She works at our hospital. She has sparked this movement here in Cresco, where instead of a protest or a rally, because we live in a small community, we all have to work together. Anything, you know, those words have negative notions towards them. So I told them that if I was going to be involved, it can't be like a rally and a protest where people are holding signs up. So she started a thing called Peaceful Conversations, Howard County, I think it's called, Howard County. And it has opened the door for people to not be political about what's going on in the world today, but to really have these hard, uncomfortable conversations that need to be acknowledged, so that it can spark action, so that we can actually change things. And we're starting local. You know, everybody wants to start with the president, but, well, besides this president, they really don't have the power that they think that they have. So start local. We're small enough where we can change our city council, we can change our school boards, we can change our sheriff, to start with people that think forward and think, you know, have these conversations that are hard and try to brainstorm how we in our community can change. And hopefully that will trickle out into the world as these kids graduate from this high school.
Your daughter, your now 15-year-old, was one of the people mm-hmm. who shared her experiences with the community through these conversations this summer. Mm-hmm. What did that feel like? What happened?
So for her, it was huge that she made a statement. She does have severe anxiety, and she was listening to some people that were kind of getting off topic, you know, and she's like, you know what, Mom, I think I'm going to go up there. And I was like, all right, I'm right here if you need me. But it wasn't until her dad walked up behind her and just squeezed her shoulder. It was like a fire ignited in her. It was like she knew that everybody that was there, I mean, it was young and old, Democrat, Republican, people from all different walks of life in our community were there, and she saw a physical representation of the support that she has. And she just, you know, when she watches the video, she's like, oh my gosh, Mom, I sound so bad. I was like, no, you were passionate, you know, you stuttered a lot, but you got out what you needed to get out. And, you know, it's different. You know, everybody knows her story here because I'm her advocate and I'm the one making videos and putting them on Facebook and telling people, all right, school board meeting, show up. But it's different to hear it from the victim. I mean, it was amazing. The things that people said to her and things that I hadn't even heard, because she keeps it all inside to save me from any grief.
It sounds like that was a moment, a truthful moment, a powerful moment, and also a moment where you felt a lot of support. But mm-hmm. here we are just a few months later, and your 11-year-old gets this phone call, a threatening racist screed.
Yes.
How are you feeling now?
I feel frustrated, and I feel frustrated with people who say that they are going to advocate for people of color in our community. And then, you know, they say this in private, but when it counts in public, they don't say anything. It seems that people are still scared to speak up, and they don't understand speaking up for people of color is also speaking up for them also, you know, making things better, making changes that they know need to happen. Everybody says they want change, but no one's doing anything about it. You know, if they just realize that they have action-oriented people like myself, we can get stuff done.
Kelly Gosch, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Kelly Gosch lives in Cresco, Iowa, with her three children and her husband when he's not deployed. In a moment, I'll talk with Chris Robinson, who grew up in Western Iowa in the 60s and 70s, and Ty Rushing, a journalist based in Sheldon. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black Voices on Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa's John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and their National Science Foundation I-Corps Training Program, helping faculty, staff, and students make an impact with their innovations and research. More at iowajpec.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black Voices. And all week long, I'm talking with Black Iowans about their lives, experiences, and ideas. And today, we are heading out of the cities into small towns or rural Iowa, where Black Iowans are often the first or the only. In about 15 minutes, I'll talk with journalist Ty Rushing, who lives in Sheldon, and he has a lot of firsts to his name. And my next guest, Chris Robinson, lives in Des Moines now, and he has for about 30 years, but he grew up in Western Iowa, where his grandparents, who raised him, owned a farm. And he is on the line with me now. Chris, hello.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great. Thank you so much for talking with me. And you are originally from Sioux City, which is not rural. In fact, it's the fourth largest city in Iowa. But I do want to talk about your family's time there, because there were a lot of things that happened in Sioux City that made your family feel unwelcome. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, at first we lived in, I guess you want to, they want to call it a little suburb called Greenville there in Sioux City, which is just kind of like in the middle of Sioux City. And then we left there and moved out to Morningside there in Sioux City on the avenue. And then when we moved there to Morningside, that's when we had people protesting. They just didn't want us there. Come to find out, I used to work at a gas station there on the avenue, and that's when I found out that they had a petition going around to get us removed from the neighborhood. And then there was a motorcycle group that came to try to tear up our grass to threaten, I guess, to kind of scare us out of the neighborhood. But none of that worked.
Do you have memories of that?
Yeah, I was old enough to remember.
Do you remember how you felt?
At first, you know, you get mad because, you know, why us? You know, just because of the color of our skin, that's the only reason why this was happening, was because of us being black in a white neighborhood. And when I seen the petition, I was able to look to see if any of the neighbors signed it. I didn't see any of the neighbors' names on it. And so they were just, I guess, hard to adjust. When me and my brother, we went to the elementary school, we were the only ones of color there. And then we went to the high school. And then when we went to East High School, there was me and my brother and then three others. And so it was total of five of us in the whole school.
Wow. What was that like for you, being the only black child in a classroom, maybe the only black child in a whole grade?
Yeah, it's different because they showed something black on the, if it was on the screen, they're looking at you.
So they were looking to you to try to help them make sense of what they were seeing, like, and what they were learning?
Yeah, I'm a kid too. I'm learning too. I'm not an adult.
Even today, living in Des Moines, you often find yourself in situations where you're the only person of color in the room.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, still today. Even on the job, when it comes to fighting racism, discrimination and stuff, I that's my pet peeve, and I do stand up for it and do fight it when I do see it.
That must be really difficult if you are the only person of color in your place of work.
It is at times, but I feel somebody has to say something, because if nobody says anything, that's part of the reason why it's racism, discrimination exists. It's because we will all go along to get along, even though we're not getting along. And so you have to say something in order to fight against it, or that's part of the reason why it exists. If nobody says anything, then it will continue on. Really no difference than today, especially with the Republican Party, with Trump, how people of color look at the party now and at Trump. A lot of people of color, we look at him as a bigot, and that people that are for him, they have to look at them in the same light, because you uphold his bigotry. And so by upholding his bigotry, well, what do you think that makes you? because you can't say you are against racism, discrimination at the same time when you are upholding racism, discrimination by somebody that is practicing it. We have a United States Senate that is practicing bigotry, but we don't say nothing about it.
From your perspective, do you feel like the past 5 years have revealed racism in this country in a new way, or at least in this sort of modern era? Do you think that we've pulled back the curtain and we see a lot of stuff that was hidden before?
Oh, yes, yes, especially with Trump. But one thing I would have to give Trump credit for is that what he has done, he has showed us who the bigots are. Now, it's up to us to believe what we see, but he has shown us who they are. There's people that are, I guarantee you, that are managers, that are supervisors, that go to these rallies and stuff, that are in charge of people of color. And so how do you think a person of color feels if they see a manager or a supervisor there at that rally? White folks don't think about it like that because it doesn't affect them. Racism, it doesn't affect them. And if it doesn't affect you, then you look at it in a different light because it doesn't affect you. It's no different than I watch Iowa Press. I used to watch it all the time, but I don't watch it as much as I used to. And part of the reason is because they don't have a person of color on there on a consistent basis. And I have been trying to get a person of color on Iowa Press for quite some time when Dan Miller was there. But when you have these politicians on your show, the folks that you have, if they're not asking questions that will Bill or a person of color would ask, because you're not asking that question, because you're not thinking the way a person of color would think. And so white folks will ask one set of questions, and black folk is going to ask a whole another set of questions, because we're treated in two different ways.
In Iowa, this has come up again and again during this week. We've had people say, oh, Iowa nice hides a lot of racist tendencies. We don't want to have these hard conversations. And, you know, I'm reluctant to generalize to all of Iowa, but do you think that there is something about the culture in our state where we don't want to talk about uncomfortable things?
We don't. I know that for a fact. A majority of white folks that I know, if we go to the race issue, they are totally uncomfortable with going to the race issue. And lots of times the reason that folks are uncomfortable is because they haven't dealt with self. They haven't dealt with their own racism.
I was talking with State Representative Roz Smith, and one of the things that he said to me off, just in conversation, not during the show, was that white people rediscover systemic racism every few years and then they forget about it. And
right.
You've been alive for quite a while. You've seen a lot of things. Do you feel like what is happening right now, this summer of reckoning that we've had, do you feel like it's different?
Oh, yes. You know, right now, today, we have to, especially us as people of color, we don't know what might happen to us on a daily basis. Just when we walk out our door, we don't know if we're going to come back. If we get pulled over by the police, we don't know what's going to happen. We could get killed in a heartbeat just because of how we look. It has started to get worse now. We don't know, as a black, they could go back to slavery on us. And to say, oh, no, that would never happen. Don't trust these folks. I don't trust none of them. Do not trust them whatsoever.
Do you feel like this is the worst that things have been in your life as far as race?
Part of the problem with racism and with bigotry, folks that are like that, lots of times they're not up front with it. If I go into a store, wherever I go, you already know I'm a person of color. I can't hide it. I can't do anything. But they could say something that's out of line, that might be out of line to me. It may not be out of line to them, but just because you may not think it's out of line, I might take it out of line. And you have folks saying, well, you're too sensitive. Now, it has nothing to do with being too sensitive. No, it's been, you've been able to say that around whoever you've been around, and everybody's not going to be okay with that.
You mentioned the importance of representation in media. You gave us a specific example, but that's something that, of course, is important across all of the different channels.
And
tell me, I'm not trying to say that you have to be the person to have all the answers, but I know you've given this a lot of thought. What do you think would make things better, would set us on a path to making things materially better?
First, you have to stop the bigotry, the racism, the discrimination. You have to stop it. We still are passing laws and stuff right now today that are based on discrimination. How many Republicans do you see running around the country trying to make sure certain folks can't vote? But we don't talk about the discrimination and the bigotry of that, because that's what it is. And so we have to be honest. We have to call it out what it is. It is what it is. You can't tell me you're not practicing bigotry when you're trying to pass laws to make sure I can't vote. But you want to say, at the same time, try to tell me you ain't doing that? I'll give you a perfect example. We have Mitch McConnell, Chuck Grassley, Lindsey Graham, the same three that took away President Obama's choice to pick for a Supreme Court justice to make sure he didn't get that choice. But you're going to make sure this president gets to put in another Supreme Court justice. He shouldn't get to. He shouldn't get to at all. But when you have folks at certain places, in high places, that make it okay and give the okay for discrimination to continue on, this is why it continues on, is because he's been given the okay. These guys okay him. But these are supposed to be so-called good people. There's no difference when you say we have good police. Well, if you have good police that don't tell on the bad police, who's the good police?
Is there anything that gives you hope right now?
What I am glad to see the younger folks starting to come out. And because for a while there was wonder. You know, I'm up in age, I'm 59, I'll be 60 next year. So I was wondering if the younger folks was going to come out, and thank God they showed up. And so that gives me hope, because there's that younger fight, to keep the fight going on. And, of course, if it's older ones, if you need our help, we're here to help. But at least we see the younger generation taking on the fight, because it's a fight that needs to be fought, because I got grandkids, too. That's why I still stay in the fight, to help fight for my grandkids, so that they don't have to go through what I have to deal with and put up with. Hopefully they don't have to. That would be nice, but if my grandkids wouldn't have to, but they probably will. It just depends on how the world, how people of the world, if you care about all people, you will care for all people, regardless of their skin color or anything. I will help anybody. It doesn't make a difference. But I also know everybody ain't going to help me.
Chris Robinson.
And that's just the reality of it.
Chris Robinson, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, you are so welcome. Thank you for doing this interview with me.
It's the worst that it's been since the last time it happened. It's happening again right in front of our eyes.
Chris Robinson, who lives in Des Moines, he grew up in Sioux City, Iowa, where his grandparents, who raised him, also owned a farm in rural Iowa. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices. And coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with journalist Ty Rushing, who lives in Sheldon, Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa.
Blocking the way, keeping us all from enjoying our evening, shoving its roots through the screens in our face.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices. Now we are traveling to Sheldon, a town of about 5,000 up in northwest Iowa. It's the home of Ty Rushing. He is managing editor at Iowa Information, which has a number of publications, including the Northwest Iowa Review. And Ty, you wrote a column not that long ago reflecting on your nearly 8 years in Iowa. You wrote, "To date, I've been the first Black staff writer at the Newton Daily News, Jasper County Tribune, Prairie City News, the Sheldon Mail Sun, the South O'Brien Sun, the Northwest Iowa Review, and the Sioux City Journal. I'm also the first person with an editor title at this company." And that is extraordinary, but I'm also curious, from your experience coming here from Kansas City, you keep being the first. What does that feel like?
It's kind of, you know, like, because I wrote in that column too, like, you know, it is what it is. I mean, it's kind of like, it's cool, like, oh, wow, I'm the first, but at the same time, it's kind of like, dang, I'm the first, you know, because, like, you know, you don't know much about Iowa if you don't live in Iowa.
Yeah.
Like, and that's a fact. And so, like, I had to learn about Iowa by being here. But, you know, only thing you know about it is, you know, farming, ag, corn, and white people. And so, like, you know, that's not really, you know, a great marketing tool if you want to, like, lure in journalists of color, like, who are, like, larger metropolitan areas, because it's kind of like, do I really want to do that? And so, like, I think that has played a role in it. And then I know we have some great college journalism programs here, too. And so, like, and I know one thing I was known for is exporting this talent. So, like, I'm kind of wondering if those, you know, up-and-coming writers of color who have, you know, went to the University of Iowa or UNI or Morningside or Drake or any of the other colleges here have, like, kind of taken those skills and went elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, actually, you know, Nicole Hannah-Jones at the New York Times is a great example of that. I mean, she's from Waterloo.
Right.
And she just won a Pulitzer.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, just to pull back the curtain here at Iowa Public Radio, we have been working toward trying to diversify our staff at Iowa Public Radio, and we've made some progress, but we do not have a Black reporter on staff. We do not have a Black person on staff. And in Iowa, that can be really hard to do, even if it's a goal.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is. I mean, my family, when I told them I was moving to Iowa, it was just like a lot of jaws dropped. Like, what? You know, like, I mean, they understood why I was doing it, but it was kind of like, are you sure about that? Are you certain? Are you going to be safe?
Yeah. Did you feel like you would be?
I mean, I was nervous. I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, I'm moving to a brand new area, small community, and, you know, I'm a large Black man, so I was very worried about how I would be accepted. And, you know, I found Newton to be an incredibly welcoming community, and I had a fantastic time there. I actually call it my Iowa hometown, just because it was such a tremendous experience for me there, personally and professionally. And so it was like the complete opposite of what I expected.
Well, and Newton, of course, being in central Iowa, it's closer to a large metropolitan area. It's closer to Des Moines, and Des Moines is a much more diverse community than, let's say, a lot of northwestern Iowa.
I didn't even think Des Moines had diversity, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
You know, because like that's how little I knew of Iowa. Like, I was like, man, where am I going to get my hair cut up here? And like, I actually got on a dating app when I was still down in Kansas City, not to hit on anyone, but just to find some women, like some Black women who could tell me where I can get my hair cut in Des Moines. And that's how I found my first barbershop.
Well, that's resourceful.
Like, so I was messaging them like, hey, where can I get my hair cut in Iowa? Instead of being like, hey, you're cute, we should meet.
Maybe that was refreshing. I don't know.
Right? You know, I'm sure that was like, oh, okay, this is all he wants. There you go.
So, moving up to Northwest Iowa, you live in Sheldon now. You've lived in Sioux City as well, which is more diverse than Sheldon. So tell me what it's like to live in Sheldon, Iowa.
I mean, obviously there's not a lot of people that look like me here.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, you know, my job, I'm out and about in the public. So my job is to, you know, get to know everybody and talk to everybody and try to, and I want my paper, like the Mail Sun, which is the hyper local paper that we produce. We got four community weeklies all together, including the Review. And my job is to, you know, cover the community, and I want to cover all of the community. And, you know, that's something I take pride in. And so, like, I want to get those brown faces, and, you know, there's not a lot of them, but I still want to get them in the paper, get them on the front page, give them some shine just as much as I do anyone else in town. Like, I mean, I want to tell stories of Sheldon, and that includes all people.
This summer, of course, after George Floyd was killed and the Black Lives Matter movement really had an incredible resurgence and is so ubiquitous right now. There have been, you know, protests in small towns in northwestern Iowa and protests all over the country. Suddenly you're in a position as a Black journalist in Iowa where people are turning to you to try to understand this movement. And that's a strange position to be in. What has that been like?
Like you said, I mean, I've done a lot of conversations, a lot of interviews. I've done a, you know, podcast, TV, radio, like you name it. Like the last few months I've done it, and just like private conversations between friends and strangers alike. You know, I know some, you know, a lot of people get like, feel like, you know, they shouldn't have to bear the burden of trying to tell the story, but I'm like, you know, like you said, like there's not too many Black journalists in Iowa. And so like, if I don't tell this story, who will, you know? I mean, I felt like there was a lot more support here in Iowa, like earlier in the summer, but like, as a thing, as you know, protests continued on and just like the way the message was twisted and corrupted and, you know, mishandled by some outlets, it's really, really tainted it.
Mm.
And that sucks. Like, I mean, there's still momentum. There's still people who are willing to take this fight on and, you know, try to push for that change. But man, it's getting tougher.
I do want to acknowledge that it is a burden. I've been in journalism for a long time, Ty, and nobody has ever said, Charity, why don't you tell us what it's like to be a white woman in Iowa? You know, I've never been asked to speak for my race. It does seem really unfair.
It's kind of like you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. Because it's like, yeah, I got to, you know, you got to try to speak for an entire race, which no one can. And then being Black, it's not a monolithic experience. But it's like, it's either, you know, if I don't talk about it and don't share those experiences and don't try to provide that context and, you know, personal information and background, like, does it get out there? You know, like, it's either I can help tell this story or maybe it doesn't get told.
Have you experienced personal attacks because of the coverage that you've done?
Oh, yes. Easily. I mean, I mean, if you go to my Twitter account at Rush the Writer, like my pinned tweet is a comic book cover that one of my designers made where it's the Black Agitator number one. Because, in the midst of all of this, like someone sent a very nasty letter to us saying that, you know, black agitators educated in the Kansas City school system are going around screaming about racism and cries of racism, blah, 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 blah. And basically just, you know, said I was making up racism and using it as an excuse to cover up for my own sins. And so, yeah. And so that was, and so my boss was like, huh, the Black Agitator, that could be your superhero name. And I was like, you're onto something here. And I talked to one of our designers. We already had that cool photo. And I was like, hey, can you make me a comic book cover? And she did. And boom, the Black Agitator was born. I mean, because, like, I deal with a lot of negativity, like, and sometimes some of it's just, like, just from being in the media in general. Some of it's yeah. doing with being black and in the media. Some of it's just being black. But I've really learned to turn those, like, lemons into lemonade. You know, like, okay, you want to call me, you know, a black agitator who was educated in Kansas City, Missouri public school system or whatever, then guess what? Black agitator is my new superhero name. Like, you know, like, turning those things around. Like, I mean, we get, you know, some really nasty things, and now we're doing Facebook Fridays where on Fridays, like, I'll post a video to Twitter of us reading some of the most ridiculous Facebook comments we got that week. And so I'm just, you know, turning these things around, like flipping it on people. Like, yeah. You want to come at me negatively, then I'm going to turn it into a positive for me.
Speaking of your boss, I would love to talk about Peter Wagner a little bit, because you and exchanged some open letters. He wrote an open letter to you asking you questions about the Black Lives Matter movement, and you answered his questions to the best of your ability. And it's just a really lovely, open conversation. And again, it seems unfair to place that burden on you to explain this, because it's not like you are the originator of the Black Lives Matter movement or anything like that. But it's also a really lovely moment of openness and exchange in a public venue. How did that come about?
Yeah, okay, so Peter's an idea man. Like, he's a salesman and an idea man. I mean, through and through. I mean, he turned, he's either 80 or 81 this year. And so, you know, he's been in the game for a long time. And so the thing about Peter is Peter's not shy. He will speak his mind. He will say his piece. He doesn't bite his tongue. And so
sounds like the two of you might have some things in common.
That we get along well. You'd be surprised to hear this. But and so Peter, like, I was actually coming in late into the office later that day, but like, he just called me up and he's like, Ty, I want to write a letter, ask you questions about Black Lives and the Black Lives Matter movement and just what's going on in our country, but I want you to respond to my letter. Would you be willing to do that? And I was like, all right, okay. And so it was either a Monday or a Tuesday afternoon when he sent me that. And so he told me he'd get it to me by Wednesday afternoon, and he didn't end up getting it to me until like Wednesday evening. And so I read his letter Thursday morning, and then I crafted my response that same morning. And then the designers laid them out on the pages Friday. We wrote headlines from both, and he didn't read my letter until Saturday. And so he never saw my letter ahead of time.
Wow.
But I got to see his ahead of time to respond to it. Yeah. And so and one thing I really appreciate about his letter is, like I said, Peter doesn't bite his tongue. He says what's on his mind. And a lot of people, some people took like umbrage with some of the things he asked me in his letter. But the thing is, the stuff he asked me is what other white people, especially older white people, are wondering about. Okay. They, you know, they just don't have, you know, like some of them just, you know, they don't want to say it, or they're just thinking it, or they talk about it privately or during coffee or something like that. But Peter will just come out and say it. And so I appreciated that, because like, it was a chance to kind of take some of those topics head on.
What was response to your open letters like?
Oh man, it was huge. We got a phenomenal response. I mean, it blew up. Like, it really, really blew up. I mean, I saw it shared all over socials. He and I both received a number of calls and emails about it. Just people saying, wow, like, we really appreciated you guys having such an open dialogue. And then especially having that kind of conversation where we are in the state, you know, cause we're, you know, it's really rural, really conservative, part of Iowa. So like, having a conversation like that, and you know, the biggest paper in this corner, it's like amazing.
In this state, we've talked about, of course, in your part of the state, there are even fewer African-Americans than there are in the larger urban centers in the state, like Waterloo, like Cedar Rapids, like Des Moines, for example. But no matter where you are in Iowa, the population of African-Americans is small. It's a small percentage of the population of the state. What do you think white Iowans need to do to have a better understanding of what it's like to be a Black Iowan and to have a better understanding of what all of us can do to make our state a place where people can experience equality?
Well, empathy. Empathy is the biggest one. I mean, I see people getting mad, like, oh, why are there protests still? Oh, why are they in the streets? You know, and it's like, okay, think about what's built up to the point that makes people say, hey, we need your attention. We want you to pay attention to us. Like, listen to us. And, like, you got so many people being just so incredibly dismissive of the reasoning for the protests, the reasoning why people were so upset. And, you know, it's like, I get so annoyed when I hear white people like, well, I've never seen any racism. You know, it's like, well, you like, are you serious? Like, of course you haven't seen it. Like, but you're probably friends with the person who's perpetrating it, or you're just like being naive. Or, you know, you just look past it and you say, oh, you know, you call it PC culture or cancel culture or something like that. And it's like, dude, like, that's not cool. Like, and so you need a better understanding of it, and you got to be willing to listen to people who are telling you, like, hey, this is the issue, instead of being so dismissive of it or acting like it's not a big deal because it doesn't impact you. Like, you got to think of others. Like, empathy is huge, 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 huge.
Well,
like, I wouldn't be able to do my job without empathy, because, you know, I'm from Kansas City, but I need to know and understand rural Iowa. I need to understand what the struggles are here in Sheldon, and I need to know what's happening in Lyon County, in Sioux County, in O'Brien County, in Osceola County, and what the issues are, the challenges are those communities face, and be able to understand that, so I can properly write about it and talk to people about it. And you got to see that reciprocated, you know, when people talk about Black lives and the struggles of being Black and the challenges that go with that.
There has been a lot more talk about anti-racism and what mm-hmm. what people who are anti-racist can do in our society to make things better. Beyond empathy, do you have a message for white Iowa to really make a difference, to make our state better?
It's not enough to not be racist. You got to be actively fighting against that. I mean, this isn't a Black versus white issue. This is a, you know, everybody against racism issue. That's what it should be. Like, you know, I mean, I don't even get on Facebook anymore because it's just so toxic. And, you know, it's like, I don't want to find out, like, this third grade teacher I got to interview next week is, you know, sharing all lives matter, yada, 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 rioters, looters kind of memes, you know, and then I have to go, you know, play nice with the person, you know, when I talk to him for this interview. Like, you got to be actively against that stuff. Like, we just can't do it alone. Like, you can't just sit on the sideline to say, well, I'm not racist, so it's not my problem. Like, no, you need to help us get rid of racism and fight back against it.
It strikes me that equality actually benefits everyone, and this racist structure that we have in our society is holding all of us back. Do you think that there's a way to help people understand that? Because part of me thinks we have to figure out why this is beneficial to all of us before people really do something.
I honestly don't know, because, I mean, if you can't see, like, the human benefit, not even, like, the societal benefit, but, like, the human benefit of treating people and treating everyone the same, like, I don't know if there's anything we can do to help you. It shouldn't be a debate to end inequality, but for some reason it is.
Ty Rushing is managing editor at Iowa Information, which has a number of publications, including the Northwest Iowa Review. This is Iowa Week 2020, listening to Black voices. On tomorrow's show, we talk about raising and educating young Black Iowans. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbie.